Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is David Black. My guest today is Dr. Julie Fritz, Distinguished Professor of Physical Therapy and Athletic Training at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, where she is also Associate Dean for Research at the College of Health. She's a licensed physical therapist and a fellow of the American Physical Therapy Association. Her current research focuses on covering best practices as treatments for low back pain, mindfulness training being one of those treatments of the many that she studies and looks at. She has had many federally funded projects. The one I will focus on today is a test of an integrated treatment program that includes mindfulness on low back pain. And this is funded by the National Institutes of Health, NCCIH. Welcome, Dr. Fritz. It's great to have you here. I read your first author publication. It was a September paper in the journal Pain Medicine. And I was super excited about it. This is a protocol report, and it's something I've been really interested in previous studies that I've conducted myself, but yours is an NIH grant. It's titled this paper at least is titled The Effectiveness of a Mindfulness-Based Intervention Integrated with Physical Therapy for Rehabilitation After Lumbar Surgery. And as we are talking, I'm super excited about this. I ran a small feasibility study at the University of Southern California, and we were really hoping to give something in addition to physical therapy for people in a lot of pain as they were coming out of ours was elbow and shoulder. Yours is low back. So it's wonderful to have you doing just a brief overview of your trial for folks. What are you seeking to accomplish with this trial?
Yeah. So, you know, part of the context for this trial is an initiative by the NIH that many of your listeners probably will be familiar with called the HEAL Initiative, which is focused on improving pain management and reducing addiction to opioids. So it's a large outlay of research funding to find non-opioid alternatives and improve pain management overall. So this particular study that we're discussing today is part of the HEAL funding initiative. So what we wanted to do and what really motivated us was to think about this population of individuals who've had spine surgery. So these are persons who've had usually many years of chronic pain and have developed behavioral patterns and pain management strategies that often involve opioids and other perhaps less than adaptive strategies. And, you know, we knew that current practices for improving pain management after surgery are, let's say, suboptimal. And as physical therapists, this is a population we see frequently. And, you know, I'm fortunate to work with colleagues who are experts in mindfulness, and through those relationships began to really understand the potential synergy of integrating mindfulness with what physical therapists do for this type of patient, with an attention on the post-surgical period and improving pain management, reducing reliance on opioids, and really helping patients improve their quality of life after such a big procedure.
And so I hear this term elective, is this what we're saying? We're saying an elective procedure because patients determine themselves if they want this. But to me, I was really trying to put myself in the head of someone who had severe and chronic back pain. And that term elective maybe isn't right when we were talking to them. And so what do we mean by elective? And perhaps a person isn't like making a full and free choice here. Like they think this is the last choice, right?
Yeah, I think you bring up some interesting points. I think in the medical world, we call it elective because at least in the near term, no one's going to die if you don't have the procedure ASAP. But you're right. The sense of sort of being at the end of the line or desperation, having, you know, failed in some way, other attempts to manage pain is often where these patients are. And, you know, another thing we often observe in individuals who are preparing and going into spine surgery is that their expectations may not be well aligned with what we know the outcomes of spine surgery are. You know, patients may understandably have in mind that whatever the thing is that's causing their pain is going to be removed and, you know, they're going to be better and they're not going to have pain and they're not going to suffer in the way that they did before surgery. And the reality is that's not the case for the majority of cases. Even good outcomes, people still have pain, usually, sometimes a good bit of pain. And so that mismatch of expectations can be one more factor in that complicates the rehabilitation.
Well, very well said. And we could see where maybe substance misuse, opioid misuse would come into play here, both before surgery. I don't know the numbers here, but if we're saying they've made it to some kind of tolerance endpoint, like we have to think about a willingness to go get spinal surgery. That says a lot where someone is. So maybe pre-existing misuse of, you know, pain medications. And then also after the fact, learning this didn't pan out the way you hoped it did. And we could see that maybe a return or first time pain medication use. So that's my guess. But how do you see more practically like pain medication use and misuse occurring in this context?
I think you framed it really well in that, you know, this for this patient population, it depends on exactly where you are, what your setting is, but half or more will be long-term opioid users for pain management. It's the nature of people who've arrived at having spine surgery. And, you know, part of our premise is that we just don't pay enough attention to helping people make that transition to better coping strategies and self-management after surgery. I think everyone, the patient as well as providers, have the sense that the surgery is just going to take care of it. And then behavioral patterns of pain management are just going to kind of magically disappear. And that kind of flies in the face of what we know about human nature. And we just didn't pay enough attention to the issue is really what we, where we started. So we wanted to be much more intentional in training providers and talking with patients about how we want to manage pain after the surgery's done.
Yeah. And we imagine if a model of negative reinforcement has led to opioid misuse, let's say, so there's been discomfort. We know mm-hmm. that taking pills alleviates discomfort. If discomfort happens after, we can't imagine that all those years of negative reinforcement just disappear. I mean, that's strongly reinforced. So yeah, you would need something pretty strong if pain still is maintained, at least to some degree, like you said, post.
Yeah. The other thing that I've really been impressed with, you know, coming to this work as someone who wasn't steeped in mindfulness, is the really critical nature of helping people be mindfully aware of what has become a habitual action when they either feel or anticipate feeling pain, which is oftentimes to use medication. And that conscious awareness of a previously habitual action, it strikes me that that's a really critical and necessary step to helping patients think about managing pain differently, is that awareness of what's triggering them to do the things that they've sort of been, that have become habit in their pain management strategies.
Well said. And I can imagine people after surgery, like you're saying, if they do get back to that initial recovery period, then you're asking them to engage in some of these physical rehab moves. Sure. There are those moments that are like, uh-oh, I recognize this is a memory. I do remember pain. And then all the oh no's that follow, I can imagine, are what we call like catastrophizing, like, okay, here we go again. I just want, and just like we all do with our minds, sometimes spin out of control, which is, I've been here before. I did all of that work, all that prep, all that pre-op could, you know, sound in one's mind terrifying, right? And so we also, like you're saying, try to reduce some of that spiraling of negative verbal behavior in one's mind, you know? So then to me, PT comes in because PT to me, I mean, I have such a positive experience with physical therapy. I have a lot of physical therapy colleagues and it's such an environment of healing. I've been there through sports med, you know, when I had my own injuries in sports, and it was always proving to me that it could be healing much more than I've seen some other fields. So I've always enjoyed this field. And so what does physical therapy have to offer? You see the patient coming out of surgery, and what is like the plan to help that patient get their function back, perhaps to a greater degree than before.
Yeah, traditionally, as physical therapists for these patients, we're trained to look at their strength, their stamina, their flexibility, and address these much more physically oriented impairments. You know, that's the basics of the way we're trained. For people who've had spine surgery, we teach them about precautions and basic biomechanics and, you know, injury prevention types of strategies. But the integration of the mindfulness piece has been very interesting in my experience in trying to train physical therapists to integrate this in, because, you know, one of the things that I didn't appreciate maybe as well as I should have is in some ways it's a very natural fit. A lot of physical therapists are like, I kind of do a semi version of some of these techniques just because it makes sense to, you know, help patients, you know, use coping strategies like mindful breathing or other kinds of techniques. But for other physical therapists, it's a big paradigm shift. And, you know, the way we're trained to think and look at patients in a rehabilitation setting is a little bit different than the way a therapist who's trained in mindfulness approaches a patient with pain. And so it's been interesting just to, you know, work with colleagues to try to integrate these different ways of looking at a patient who's been dealing with chronic pain for a long time, address the physical needs, but then integrate this larger construct of mindfulness. We often explain it to patients within our trial as, you know, the mental part of the rehabilitation that they need to go through. And that seems to kind of resonate, even though that sort of duality is probably a little reductionist in the way we would think about it. But it seems to resonate with patients as well as physical therapists.
Yeah, and as physical therapists, I imagine I totally get that paradigm shift, because observing some of the PT courses, like in the doctoral programs at our university, it's like biokinesiology, movement angles. Here's the assessment of what angle the knee could take at this level, and can you increase that capacity? It's very body, body centric. Body, did you improve this assessment on the body? Makes a ton of sense. But it's right there, like you're saying, at the crux of, well, where is the person element? And I've seen that also. A lot of PT has that. Like,
yeah.
And I think PT does great with like client engagement,
yes,
like that good rapport that a PT trained folk will usually have, like the ability to want to motivate this person to return. It's all there. And yep. The paradigm slightly shifts into, what agency does the person bring to this moment outside of their motor skill, which is kind of that link to what you're saying.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I do agree that in general, it's a good fit with the way physical therapists interact with patients, the kind of ways that we've developed to build alliances with our patients, just the amount of time that physical therapists often have with patients, which is very different than particularly physicians or other providers, and the kind of relationships you can build when you see a person, you know, several times a week over a long rehabilitation period.
And going back to the trial, so we're going to have two groups in this trial. Do you want to talk about the two conditions? What is a standard of care for a person who's in rehabilitation after this type of surgery? And what are you trying to build on? What is that program
like? Yeah, so one interesting thing to note about this trial is we're conducting the trial within the military health system. So we're working in military hospitals, which is, you know, in some ways presents some very unique aspects. In other ways, people are people, and the way pain affects people is fairly human. We're seeing a patient population that includes both active duty individuals, which comes with some interesting implications for your career and your advancement when you're dealing with things like chronic back pain, as well as family members, dependents, other individuals who aren't in those situations. So that's just a little bit of context. But in terms of the trial itself, we have a usual care arm, which It seems like it ought to be a fairly straightforward question, is what is usual care after spine surgery, but it's a little more heterogeneous than we might want to think it is. But in basic way we've built it in this trial is to take a pragmatic approach and allow usual care to be what the surgeon usually does, which sometimes involves physical therapy, sometimes it doesn't. It depends a little bit on the patient and the provider's preference. So we have an arm where we just do whatever would happen in the normal course of events. And then we have this integrated physical therapy and mindfulness arm. And for that arm, we see the patients one time before surgery. We teach them a very basic mindfulness practice. We kind of orient them to what we're going to do after surgery and how we're going to approach their rehabilitation. And then when it's appropriate, based on the surgical precautions for them to start, we make sure we do all the standard evidence-based physical therapy interventions, education, exercise. And then we've set up a way to integrate in techniques of mindfulness across the protocol for physical therapy. So we work with the patients on mindfulness practices. We build on what we taught them pre-surgically. We work with them on understanding cognitive reappraisal of their thoughts. We work with them on an important part of the mindfulness program of the colleagues that I'm working with here at Utah is positive savoring of pleasurable, naturally pleasurable activities that that perhaps in the midst of dealing with chronic pain have been lost to the patient. So we train the physical therapist to integrate exercises with their physical therapy exercises that tap into these components of the mindfulness approach.
And that's what we wanted to. So in our trial, the original or the final goal would have been full integration of a mindfulness teacher, like a teacher of teachers to yeah. train the physical therapists and to get buy-in that this is like an element. It's definitely not the key job description, but an element of what they can provide. And then we would have instructional booklets and things to take mm-hmm. home so they could complete meditation practices yep. On their own. And you're doing it a more challenging way. We were just trying to see if we could do it by the phone. And so we're doing phone delivery. And so that way we could just keep our teachers, the teacher of teacher type folks that have been doing like MBSR, mindfulness training delivery for 10 plus years. But this, your way is much more healthcare oriented, which is if we could train people well with high fidelity and they can get this across, we already have, the healthcare personnel. They're already there. We can just add to the repertoire of delivery methods, of intervention
yeah.
methods.
I mean, that was really our premise was, it wasn't going to be realistic to use behavioral health providers. I think this would be true in civilian or military health systems. You know, these individuals are in high demand. Their availability is really often very challenging. So we wanted to take the workforce that was there and already working with these individuals and you know, train them at least in understanding some basics of mindfulness and mindfulness techniques. And, you know, in a lot of ways, we're experimenting as much on the physical therapists as we are on the patients about their ability to deliver care with fidelity and how that's going to influence patients. And, you know, I think we view this study as not exactly a pilot, but preliminary to wanting to kind of create training programs that could scale out helping physical therapists be able to provide this kind of care.
Yeah, it's a cohort, as we mentioned, who has the people skills. I don't know if that's something you have qualifications for, but it just seems of all the folks that I've observed in large rooms of PT happening, the people skills were very high. So it seems
yeah,
like
I think in general, I think as we do more and more of this, we'll find that there are some physical therapists for whom this is really challenging and, you know, for whatever reason, just doesn't quite fit their paradigm of treating patients. And it's just difficult for them. And I think for the majority of physical therapists, though, within the adequate amount of training, they'll adapt to it quite well, and I think we'll find it quite useful across a broad range of patients, particularly those with chronic kind of conditions.
And so this is, you're going to allocate treatments across two groups, parallel groups, everyone's running the same time span, moving forward. Some people are going to get that usual pain management you talked about, and then the mind PT, this is the physical therapy plus mindfulness training. And then you assess at pre-surgery, 2 weeks later, and then 26 weeks later. And so those windows, why is that important? I'm assuming it's in relation to classic recovery paradigms and also PT delivery.
Yeah, the 2 week, well, we wanted to assess people before surgery. And then we wanted to get kind of a after the surgery baseline before rehabilitation started, at least for people in the experimental group. So that's the rationale for a 2 week assessment. It kind of gives us, as you can imagine, a lot of things change once you have back surgery. And then the 26 week, which is 6 month follow-up, allows, you know, a complete course of rehabilitation to occur. We know from recovery curves of people with back pain that they'll hopefully continue to improve somewhat beyond 6 months, but the majority of the improvement that's going to happen will be evident by then. You know, ideally, if we had a little more time to do the study, we'd love to have at least a year outcome. But as I said, you know, we kind of view this study as preliminary to wanting to do larger studies with longer follow-ups.
Yeah, and as it's good that follow-up period you have plus the control condition, because as we found, and as you probably well know, we found in our previous work that, you know, immediately that 2 weeks after surgery, people are, your program, any program is going to look terrible because everyone's doing bad because they're in recovery. They're like the highest point of like pain recovery. And then you'll see everyone getting better. And you, if you only had one group, you'd assume that it's the intervention, but people are just going to report getting better and better since that immediate post because they're healing. Like you, I mean, I don't know everybody, but on average.
No, on average, you're 2 weeks, you're probably about as miserable as you're going to get, and then you're going to get better. And the question is whether the addition of the mindfulness to sort of usual process facilitates, accelerates the improvement. And, you know, we really have two key outcomes. One is physical function, the ability of the patient to engage in daily activities of life and their quality of life. But then also, as I mentioned previously, how long does it take them to discontinue postoperative opioids? That's another outcome that we're focused in on, just given most everybody at least gets a short course of opioids after surgery. And we want to look at how rapidly we move people off of needing those for pain management. Because we know that if patients are still taking opioids regularly by about 90 days or so, their ability to transition away from that starts to get, you know, really, really challenging.
Yeah, and I was really intrigued by that outcome. And this is, you're pulling this from a database site, if I remember that correctly. How does that work? And that seems like a really good measure. How are you pulling that?
You know, there's a big advantage to, one big advantage to working in the military health system is it's a fairly closed system. So any opioid prescription from a provider, whether it's primary care provider or the surgeon or anyone in the system, is included in the same database, the same data repository, so we can extract that. So we don't have to worry. I mean, we can't pick up illicit use of opioids or getting them, you know, from non-prescription sources. Those aren't obviously going to show up. But unlike sometimes in civilian systems where patients may not always be getting care within one system, we are able to identify all of their prescription opioid use that comes through the military health system.
Yeah, that's excellent. Everyone can imagine the challenge of getting correct self-reports if people think this is not the desired behavior and underreporting. I'm assuming it heads in the direction of underreporting. And now you're at least having this system that you can confirm, you know, negative and positive reporting if they both align, and then, you know, probably lean towards the system if they're still, you know, filling prescriptions, but reporting that they are not using. So very useful measure. And it, also takes us in the direction of having good objective outcomes. Like maybe this can be bolstered in the future with various systems. So that's very useful. Did you want to mention something about the exposure, the PT rehabilitation program? How many, is this weekly? Did you mention that? How many times per week? And then how long does it go? And how much mindfulness do people get?
We set it up to be 10 weekly sessions, which is fairly typical. There is no, you know, one standard, but that's, I think, in within the range of what's normal. So 10 weekly sessions, and every other session, our protocol has an explicit mindfulness task, either to reinforce something or to teach a new skill. You know, what we find with talking with the physical therapists that are now doing this is there's also these intermittent opportunities to reinforce a concept, or a patient has a question. So, you know, we don't want them to be so rigid that they, you know, they start the stopwatch and there's 5 minutes of mindfulness and then they don't talk about it. That's not integration. But we do have explicit times every other session where we make sure there's time set aside either to practice, reflect, or repeat some of the mindfulness training that we've done.
And this is the, what a hugely impressive thing that you're accomplishing here are the sites. So it looks like you're in San Antonio, Texas, Tacoma, Washington, Honolulu, Hawaii. How are you coordinating all that? That is a massive undertaking.
It is, but I, you know, I work with a really great team of researchers who've worked at these sites and, you know, worked within the military health system and, you know, have really created an infrastructure where we can do this kind of work. And so I personally can't take much credit, but it is, you're right. It's a significant undertaking to just have the personnel and to coordinate and to create consistency across sites that are that geographically diverse and diverse in other ways as well.
And when a researcher is able to pull so many sites off like that and get representation from all these groups, it's nice. It makes a nice a generalizable effect and said, well, it could happen at any of these centers. If these are representative, we can have any medical center deliver this and we can expect somewhat of a similar effect size. So that really makes it outstanding. And so your primary outcome, we didn't touch on that. You said this really important one about opioid use, and there is a data repository to get that. The primary outcome being this pain, enjoyment, and general activity scale. Why do you think that's really important? We're thinking about this humanistically, like the patient's quality of life, and they're entering our treatment. We're trying to help people. Why was that a good one for you?
Yeah, we generally call this thing the PEG, pain, enjoyment, and quality of life, or pain, enjoyment, and general activity. It's a measure of pain interference. So, and it really is considered more person-centered for pain research. So, you know, historically, we'd often focus on pain intensity, rate your pain from 0 to 10. And, you know, there's a lot about those kinds of measures that can be a bit problematic, a little challenging to interpret. And they're not as patient-centered in the sense that they don't really reflect the ability of a person to do the things in life that they want to do, which is generally what people are most concerned about when they come in for care for chronic pain conditions is, their pain reduction is a part of it and it's reflected in the PEG scale. But there's also the ability to just participate in the activities of life that bring joy, even if there is some degree of discomfort that goes along with kind of general life. So pain interference as opposed to pain intensity, a lot of people now view as a more patient-centered outcome to focus on.
Yeah, that seems extremely important from a patient perspective. I'm just thinking right now myself, can I do the things I want to do? There's nothing more reinforcing than that, right? Can I get up and see my friends? That's extremely a reinforcement of positive behavior. So seems very telling about what we can potentially learn here. Is there anything else that you want to talk about the trial currently? Where does it stand? How do you feel about it?
We're recruiting at all the sites you mentioned. We've enrolled, I think, about 20% of our patient population. It's been challenging, as nearly all clinical research has in a time of COVID, especially, you know, operating rooms, surgeries that are considered elective are often, you know, not prioritized when we've had successive waves of COVID precautions. But, you know, hopefully those kinds of restrictions are mostly behind us, and things have kind of settled out into more of a status quo for our recruitment. So, you know, I think we're moving forward towards our goals for recruitment and hope to be able to, you know, get that done on time, recruiting through this year and next.
Well, good luck with such a large scientific undertaking. I'm so excited to see these results. I'm excited about the field in general with what you're doing. Physical therapy seems an amazing place to integrate with whole person treatment. I think that's kind of the mindfulness-based approach. What can the person do as an agent to manage unpleasant emotions, cognitions? And part of that is a lack of being able to behave the way we want to do, like doing the things we want to do. So good luck with the trial. And just a fun question at the end, I ask everyone, if you had a full free day, where would you spend it? What would you do?
Well, you know, I live here in Utah. So when I get a full free day or even can carve out part of a day, I generally want to be in the mountains that are all around me. Ideally hiking or, you know, snowshoeing, doing something really enjoyable. So I'm fortunate to live in a beautiful place and I don't have to travel very far to have a really wonderful day when I've got the time for it.
I'm so jealous. Snowshoeing. That sounds so much fun. I've done that a few times. Can you do that local to where you are?
Oh, yeah.
Snowshoeing trails?
Absolutely.
Oh, that's awesome. We'll conclude for today. Thank you, Dr. Fritz. It was wonderful getting to know you and talking with you. Listeners can find our podcast at goamra.org. Bye now.